90.7 FM.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Kirby Crone of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click Donate. Thank you for your support.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies. You're listening to me, Norman Douglas. The name of the show is Goodnight Norman on WGXC 90.7 FM. Broadcasting to you right now live at 12.02 a.m. on the morning of December 6th, 2021. The birthday of my old man in 340 days since he died. Yesterday, the 5th, was the first and second anniversary of the last day on earth of a couple local guys I kinda knew, but if you've lived around here for as long as they both did, you maybe knew them better. The day before yesterday, Saturday, the 4th of December, there was a new moon total solar eclipse invisible to creatures and things here in what's called North America. Today I looked up the word eclipse and learned it derives from the Latin eclipsis, from the Greek eclipsis, which means to be eclipsed, literally to forsake one's accustomed place, to fail. To appear. I know of a lot of guys who've elected to fail to appear in the last couple few years. Two Tims, a Tyler, a Chris, a Jason, my old man. Maybe you know some yourself. So maybe tonight's show is about forsaking this place, as if what I don't perceive is partly the other's willful refusal to appear. A predictable event, the eclipse of a thing is part of the thing not showing up to be this thing, kinda. The first story I'm going to read is by a guy named Buck Young. I couldn't find anything out about Buck Young. It was published in the Southern Cross Review, issue number 34. I believe the current issue is now 140-something. It's a review of Anthroposophy, fiction, education, science, current events, essays, book reviews, poetry. I didn't know that when I first was turned on to this story, but I learned that looking hard for some information about Buck Young. I couldn't find anything. Anyways, the name of this piece is An Historical Overview of the whereabouts of gnomes and elves, fauns and fairies, goblins, ogres, trolls and bogies, nymphs, sprites and dryads, past and present. A long, long time ago, the earth belonged to the creatures of the wood. By creatures of the wood, I mean gnomes, elves, fairies, etc. They tended it and took care of it, played in it, danced and sang in it, cared for wounded animals, worked out disputes between species, sat on mushrooms discussing matters of importance and drinking Labrador tea, rode down streams on leaves and bark, parachuted from trees on dandelion seeds. This was the world into which mankind was born. These early days when man was but a newly arrived dinner guest who hadn't yet taken over the house are fairly well documented in the literature and folklore of the world. So there's no need to go into it here. What I am interested in, and what I am asking you to be interested in, is the question, where did all the gnomes, elves, fairies, fauns and goblins, ogres, trolls and bogies, nymphs, sprites and dryads go? The friction between man and the wood creatures began with the discovery of agriculture. With this discovery, civilization arose and spread. The forests were cleared to provide wood for shelters and fields, for pastures and crops. Mankind had set up camp. No longer just a visitor in someone else's world, he pushed the wild back from his newly built doorstep. At first, this wasn't a problem. There weren't that many people, and everyone else felt that it was only fair to allot them their own half-acre to do with as they wished. Some of them even decided to help out. Gnomes moved into the barn houses and helped with the gardening chores. The Devic spirits of the vegetables helped humans better organize their crops and plan rotation, taught them the correlation between planetary and lunar cycles and the agricultural year. They taught them to plant radishes when the moon is in Cancer, harvest when the moon is in Taurus. Many trolls felt that the heaping piles of manure were a change for the better. They decided to stick around, too. The rest of the wood creatures just backed off into the wood, occasionally playing tricks on the new settlers, like turning the milk sour, rearranging furniture, tipping cows, tickling people's faces in their sleep, and once in a while stealing babies and leaving bundles of wood in their place. But man's dominion spread and spread and spread and spread, and the forest got smaller and smaller and smaller. Things got real crowded in the woods, and things were getting worse in civilization. Most farmers weren't listening to the Devic spirits anymore. People found they could increase their output by disregarding the needs of the earth. They were raising productivity and killing the soil. Petrochemicals were just a step away. Most of the Devic spirits and gnomes fled. The trolls stayed. Today they live mostly under bridges and in the shallow, mucky ditches beneath the metal grating on farm roads that cows are afraid to cross. Be sure to honk your horn before driving over one of these. A troll may be hanging from the grate, swinging over its living room, as they are apt to do after rolling in muck and manure. If you don't give a warning honk, you may run over its fingers, and it's not a great idea to get either your name or your license plate number on a troll's shit list. Now there's little wildland left at all, and even that is shrinking at an unprecedented rate. There is simply not enough wild space for all the gnomes and the elves, fauns and fairies, goblins, ogres, trolls and bogies, nymphs, sprites and dryads. So where are they? Are they dead? No. So where did they go? The answer is a bit surprising. They didn't go anywhere. We did. Early humans had an intuitive knowledge of their role in nature, just as bears and raccoons and mice and every other critter does. They understood from the ways of the wild around them that nothing ever comes from nowhere and nothing ever just disappears. Things change form. Death is necessary for life to continue. They offered up their kills as sacrifices to the gods of nature. Humans offered praise, prayer, sacrifice, and song to the spirits of the wild, to Brother Buffalo, Brother Deer, Brother Tree. Now we know that everything that ever existed continues to exist in one form or another, and as far as we can tell, they were more aware of that back then than we are now. So the sacrifice, song, and prayer did not ensure the immortality of the slaughtered either in body or spirit. That was already taken care of. What it did ensure was the continuance of the connection between the spirit of the slaughterer and the spirit of the slaughtered. Killing is risky business. The membrane separating the internal from the external is not necessarily as thick or as clearly defined as we have come to believe. Every time we kill, we risk killing the reality of that thing inside ourselves as well as outside. We risk breaking the connections that lead in and out of the membrane. Taking a life to feed life requires a keen understanding of the natural law of give and take. When we lost that understanding, gave up the songs, the sacrifice, the prayers, we lost the connection. Saying grace isn't enough. When we lose those connections, everything becomes dead. Fish, rivers, frogs, mice, even each other. There is no way they can reach inside us anymore. The five senses we are left with are not enough. We have given up those connections in exchange for the freedom to clear-cut forest with skidders, turn cows into milk machines and chickens into egg factories. We can experiment with animals, club seals, wear fur, and exterminate entire species. Not a twinge of guilt. The lines have been severed, and we are all under the impression that it is the forests, the creatures, the spirits, and the wild lands that are disappearing from the universe, and not us. This is not so. Thinking like that is like thinking that if you stand on the end of a limb and saw that limb from the tree, that the tree will fall and you will remain standing. Bugs Bunny might be able to get away with that, but we can't. It is we who have fallen away from the real world into a world where we may carry out our twisted, sterile dreams without threatening the earth and its inhabitants. Ever wonder why the trees, stones, rivers, and streams, birds, bears, frogs, and snakes no longer talk to us as they did in the early tales of Native America, the Hindu, the Africans, the Bible? It's because we're not around to talk to anymore. Every clear cut, every vivisection, every mechanized slaughter of cow, pig, or chicken moves our dream world further and further from the tree, making a reunification, which is still possible, more and more difficult. Somewhere not so far from here in the real world, the ancient forests are still standing. The buffalo roams the prairies. The sky is full of condors. The deer and the antelope play. And dodo birds still wander the sandy beaches, bumping into things. Where there are still wild lands in our dream worlds, strong connections still exist. Bridges, tunnels, portals. Occasionally, a traveler will get lost in the wilderness and find himself in the real world, returning the next day to find that 100 years have passed, or never returning at all. There are more ephemeral connections as well. Brooks and waterfalls where you can still hear voices from the other side if you listen carefully enough. When they sit by these waters, the ancient ones hear loud clanking and screams. When they eat magic mushrooms, everything stops glowing, and condos rise where forests stand. Our children can see their world in their dreams. Their children see our world in their nightmares. There is another connection. Sometimes agents from the other side infiltrate our world in an attempt to expedite reunification. Believe it or not, they miss us over there. Sometimes, more often than you might think, they send souls over to our world to be born as human babies. There are quite a lot of them, actually. Gnomes, elves, fairies, sprites, etc., running around in human bodies, doing crazy things, like writing on walls, working in co-ops, running inns in the mountains, talking to themselves in the streets, making pottery, practicing witchcraft. They are planting biodynamic gardens, sitting in the backyard, naked, arguing with Satan. They're in asylums, pumped full of Thorazine, in a classroom on Ritalin and lithium. They live with Indians. They run recycling centers. They are starting revolutions, corrupting the young, inventing paranoid conspiracy theories, making up religions. They're directing movies, gobbling acid, drinking heavily, and writing poetry. The transition from their world to ours is not an easy one. It's not easy on the soul, and much is lost. They may have no idea who or what they are at first. They may or may not find out. They will know they are not like other people. They will know that this world is not theirs. They will faintly remember something better where things made sense and worked like they ought to, where love and magic had the power to heal. They will know what makes other people happy does not make them happy, and that what makes them happy makes them happier than anyone else alive. They will see things others cannot see, hear things others cannot hear, feel things others cannot feel, and know things others do not know. They will laugh a great deal, or cry a great deal, or both. They will love humans individually, but have a hard time with humanity as a whole, and that will occasionally approach loathing. They will have a handful of very close friends, and often be very lonely. They will be unhappiest when forced to act like a human and do things that humans do, want what humans want, or when they are convinced that they actually are human. Things will not be easy for them. Because of their memories of the other side, the world will seem to them a wondrous calliope, with just a few teeth missing on one of the cogs. Because of this tiny deficiency, the music is off-key. The horses are crashing into each other, and the children are frightened, bruised, and crying. The solutions will seem obvious, but no one will listen. They will repeatedly be punished for shouting fire in a crowded theater when the buildings really are in flames, but no one else can see. They will get slapped on the wrist for pointing to the exit signs when everyone is running around screaming and trampling one another. They will be zealous, fanatical, and didactic in their beliefs. They will feel utterly confused. They will have ecstatic visions and babble incoherently. They will be extremely articulate. They are prone to long periods of silence. They have no idea how to say what they really mean. They spend a lot of time with children and animals. They will become drunkards and dope fiends, organic gardeners, soap makers, carpenters, madmen, magicians, jugglers and clowns, lunatic physicists, painters and scribblers, travelers and wanderers. They will dress in bright colors, frumpy sweaters, or all black. They will smoke too much and drink too much. They will eat only macrobiotic foods. They will develop addictions to Mountain Dew. They will often be accused of living in their own fantasy world. They will make great lovers. Yes, even the trolls. They will spend too much time either making love or thinking about it. They will speak to inanimate objects. They will have much brighter eyes than everyone else. They will expect their magic to work in this world and their love to heal, and will be crushed by this world and often won't expect it. It will come close to killing them. They will visit the places where the connections still exist, the waterfalls, the mountains, the oceans, the forests. They will draw on all the power they have, and sometimes the magic will work, and everything will be wondrously easy. The teeth will grow back on the cog on the calliope, the tune will right itself, the horses will bob gracefully up and down, around and around, and the children will giggle and sing with cotton candy stuck to their cheeks and noses. They will spend their days trying to reconnect a branch that millions are busy sawing away at it. Often, it will be more than they can bear, while the rest of humanity is busy working on new and more efficient ways to lay waste to the earth with the push of a button. They are saving it, a handful at a time. They will share a common conviction that they are the only sane individuals in a world gone mad. And they are right. Okay, that was Buck Young. An historical overview of the whereabouts of gnomes and elves, fauns and fairies, goblins, ogres, trolls and bogies, nymphs, sprites and dryads, past and present, somewhere around the mid-noughts in the Southern Cross Review. Next, I'm going to read this amazing story, very timely, written in 1969 or published in 1969, by one James Tiptree, Jr., in the book The Future is Female, a book of all-female science fiction all science fiction stories penned by females. The reason, of course, that James Tiptree is named James Tiptree is that Alice Shelton chose that name as a pseudonym, and many critics actually spoke about what a great masculine voice she had, not knowing that she was in fact not a masculine person. She was married. She was also, which may make this story a little weirder, one of the members of the first iteration of the CIA right after World War II. She was in a specialist in photo analysis and African politics. But she was a woman. So this story is called The Last Flight of Dr. Ain, published in 1969 by James Tiptree Jr., the pseudonym for Alice Sheldon. Dr. Ain was recognized on the Omaha-Chicago flight. A biologist colleague saw him in an aisle seat while coming back from the toilet. 5 years before, this man had been jealous of Ain's huge grants. Now he nodded coldly and was surprised at the intensity of Ain's response. If he had not had the flu, like everyone else that autumn, he would have turned back to speak with Ain, but he shuffled on to his seat. The stewardess, handing out coats after they landed, remembered Ain, too, a tall, thin, nondescript man with rusty hair. He held up the line, staring at her, and since he already had his raincoat with him, she decided it was some kooky kind of pass and waved him on. They both saw Ain shamble off into the airport smog, apparently alone. Despite the big civil defense signs, O'Hare was late getting underground. Neither of them saw the woman, the wounded, dying woman. Nobody recalled him on the flight to New York, but the 240 jet carried an Ames on the checklist, which was thought to be a misspelling of Ain. It was. The plane had circled for an hour while Ain watched the smoky seaboard monotonously tilt, straighten, and tilt again. The woman was weaker now. She coughed, picking weakly at the scabs on her face that were half hidden behind her hair. Her hair, Ains saw, that great hair which had been so splendid, was drabbed and thinning. He looked to seaward, willing himself to think of cold, clean breakers. On the horizon he saw a vast spreading black rug. Somewhere a tanker had opened its vents. The woman coughed again. Ain closed his eyes. It was the dead time of afternoon. He was picked up next while checking in for the BOAC flight to Glasgow. Kennedy Underground was a boiling stew of people breathing each other's reek, the air conditioning unequal to the hot September evening. The check-in line swayed and sweated, staring dully at the newscasts. Save the last Green Mountains, a conservation group was protesting the defoliation and drainage of the Amazon basin. Several people recalled the beautifully colored shots of the new clean bomb. The line squeezed together to let a band of uniformed men go by. They were wearing buttons inscribed, "Who's Afraid?" That was when a woman noticed Ain. He was holding a news sheet and she heard it rattling in his hand. Her family hadn't caught the flu, so she looked at him sharply. Sure enough, his forehead was sweaty. She herded her kids to the side, away from Ain. He was using Instay throat spray, she remembered. She did not think much of Instay. Her family used Clear. While she was looking at him, Ain suddenly thrust his head down and stared in her face with the spray still floating above him. That made her mad. Such inconsideration. She turned her back. She did not recall him talking to any woman, but she perked up her ears when the clerk read off Ain's destination. Moscow. The clerk recalled that, too, with disapproval. Ain checked in alone, he reported. No woman had been ticketed for Moscow, but it would have been easy enough to split up the tickets. By that time, they were sure she was with him. Ain's flight went via Iceland with an hour's delay at Keflavik. Ain walked over to the airport park, breathing gratefully the sea-filled air. Every so often he shuddered. Under the whine of bulldozers, the sea could be heard, running its huge paws up and down the keyboard of the land. In the little park were yellowed birches, and a flock of wheat-eaters foraged by the path. Next month they would be in North Africa. 2,000 miles of tiny wing-beats, Ain thought. He threw them some crumbs from a packet in his pocket. The woman seemed stronger here. She was panting in the sea air, her large eyes fixed on Ain. He saw that the birches were as gold as those where he had first seen her, the day his life began. Squatting down to watch a shrew mouse he had been, when he caught the falling ripple of green and recognized the shocking naked girl flesh, creamy, pink-tipped among the golden bracken coming towards him. Young Ain held his breath under stress, his nose on the sweet moss and his heart going crash, crash. And then he was staring at the outrageous fall of that hair down her narrow back, watching it dance around her heart-shaped buttocks while the shrew mouse ran over his paralyzed hand. The lake was utterly still, dusty silver under the misty sky, and she made no more than a muskrat's ripple to rock the floating golden leaves. The silence closed back, the trees burning silent like torches where the naked girl had walked the wild wood, and Ain's eyes were shining. For a time he believed he had seen an Oread. Ain was last on board for the Glasgow leg. The stewardess recalled dimly that he had stayed awake. She could not identify the woman. There were a lot of women on board, and babies. Her passenger list had had several errors. At Glasgow Airport, a waiter remembered that a man like Ain had called for Scottish oatmeal and eaten two bowls, although, of course, it wasn't really oatmeal. A young mother with a pram saw him tossing crumbs to the birds. When he checked in at the BOAC desk, he was hailed by a Glasgow professor who was going to the same conference at Moscow. This man had been one of Ayn's teachers. It was now known that Ayn had done his postgraduate work in Europe. They chatted all the way across the North Sea. "I wondered about that," the professor said later. "Why have you come round about?" I asked him. He told me the direct flights were booked up. This was found to be untrue. Ayn deliberately avoided going to Moscow, apparently as an amateurish attempt to avoid detention. The professor spoke with relish of Ayn's work. "Brilliant? Oh, aye, and stubborn, too, very stubborn. It was as though a concept, often the simplest relation, mind you, would stop him in his tracks, fascinate him, so he would hunt all round it instead of going on to the next thing as a more docile mind would. Truthfully, I wondered at first if he could be just a bit thick. But you recall who it was said that the capacity for wonder at matters of common acceptance occurs in the superior mind, and of course, so it proved when he shook us all up over that enzyme-coating business. A pity your government took him away from his line there. No, he said nothing of this. I say it to you, young man. We spoke, in fact, largely of my work. I was surprised to find he'd kept up. He asked me what my sentiments about it were, which surprised me again. Now understand, I'd not seen the man for 5 years, but he seemed, well, perhaps just tired, as who isn't? I'm sure he was glad to have a change. He jumped out for a leg stretch wherever we came down, Oslo, even at Bonn. Oh, yes, he did feed the birds, but that was nothing new for Ayn. His social life when I knew him, radical causes. Young man, I've said what I've said because of who it was that introduced you. But I'll have you know it was an impertinence in you to think ill of Charles Ayn, or that he could do a harmful deed. Good evening." The professor said nothing of the woman in Ayn's life. Nor could he have, although Ayn had been much with her in the university time. No one had seen how he was obsessed with the miracle, the wealth of that body, her inexhaustibility. They met privately at his every spare moment, sometimes even in public, pretending to be casual strangers under his friends' noses, pointing out a pleasing view to each other, gravely formal. And later, what doubled intensity of love. He reveled in her, possessed her, and searched over every atom of her, the sweetest springs and shadowed places and the white, rounded glory in the moonlight, finding always more, always new ways to never-failing delights. The danger of her frailty was far off then in the rush of bird songs and the springing leverets of the meadow. On dark days she might cough a bit, but so did he. In those years he had had no thought to the urgent study of disease. At the Moscow conference, nearly everyone noticed Ayn at some point or another, which was to be expected in view of his professional stature. Ayn was late in. A day's reports were over, and his was to be on the third and the last. It was a small, high-caliber meeting. Many people spoke with Ayn, and several sat with him at meals. No one was surprised that he spoke little, since he was a retiring man, except on a few memorable occasions of hot argument. He did strike some of his friends as a bit tired and jerky. An Indian molecular engineer who saw him with the throat spray, kidded him about bringing over Asian flu. A Swedish colleague recalled that Ayn had been called away to the transatlantic phone at lunch, and when he returned, Ayn had volunteered the information that something had turned up missing in his home lab. There was another joke, and Ayn said cheerfully, "Oh yes, quite active." At that point, One of the Chi-Com biologists swung into his daily propaganda chore about bacteriological warfare and accused Ain of manufacturing biotic weapons. Ain took the wind out of his sails by saying, "You're perfectly right." By tacit consent, there was very little talk about military applications, industrial dusting, or subjects of that type, and nobody recalled seeing Ain with any woman other than old Madame Vialcha, who could scarcely have played Mata Hari. Ain's own speech was bad, even for him. He always had a poor public voice, but his ideas were usually expressed with the lucidity so typical of a first-rate original mind. This time he seemed muddled, with little new to say. His audience excused this as the muffling effects of security. He then got somehow into a tangled point about the course of evolution, in which he seemed to be trying to show that something was very wrong indeed. When he wound up with a reference to Hudson's bellbird, quote, singing for a later race, unquote, several listeners wondered if he were drunk. The big security break came right at the end, when he suddenly began to describe the methods he had used to mutate and redesign a leukemia virus. He explained the procedure with admirable clarity in four sentences, and paused. Then he said other sentences about the effects of the mutated strain. It was maximal only on the higher primates, he said. Recovery rate among the lower mammals and other orders was close to 100%. As to vectors, he went on, any warm-blooded animal served. In addition, the virus retained viability in most environmental media and performed very well airborne. Contagion rate was, of course, extremely high. Almost offhand, he added that no test primate or accidentally exposed human had survived beyond the 22nd day. These words fell into a silence, broken only by the running feet of a Chi-Com delegate making for the door. Then a gilt chair went over as an American bolted after him. Ain seemed unaware that his audience was in a state of unbelieving paralysis. It had all come so fast. A man who had been blowing his nose was staring pop-eyed around his handkerchief. Another who had been lighting a pipe grunted at as his fingers singed. Two men chatting by the door had missed his words entirely, and their laughter chimed into a dead silence, in which echoed Ain's words, "Really, no point in attempting." Later they found he had been explaining that the virus utilized the body's own immunomechanisms, and so defense was by definition hopeless. That was all. Ain looked around vaguely for questions and then started down the aisle. By the time he got to the door, people were swarming after him. He wheeled about and said rather crossly, "Yes, of course, it is very wrong. I told you that. We're all wrong. But now, it's over." An hour later, they found he had gone, having apparently reserved a Sinair flight to Karachi. Our security men caught up with him at Hong Kong. By then, he seemed really very ill and went with them peacefully. They started back to the States via Hawaii. His captors were civilized types. They saw he was gentle and treated him accordingly. They took him out handcuffed for a stroll at Osaka. He had no weapons or drugs on him, and they let him feed his crumbs to the birds and listened with interest to his account of the migration routes of the common brown sandpiper. He was very hoarse. At that point, he was wanted only for the security breach. There was no question of a woman at all. He dozed most of the way to the islands, but when they came in sight, he pressed to the window and began to mutter. The security man behind him got the first inkling that there was a woman in it and turned on his recorder. "Blue, blue and green until you see the scales. Oh, my girl. Oh, beautiful. You won't die. I won't let you die. I tell you, my girl, it's all over now. Hold on. It's over. Lustrous eyes. Look at me. Let me see you now alive, my girl. Oh, great queen, my sweet body, my girl. Have I saved you? Oh, terrible to know and noble. Chaos's girl, green-robed in blue and gold in light. The throne and spinning ball of life against black space. Have I saved you? On the last leg, he was obviously feverish. She may have tricked me, you know, he said confidentially to the government man. You have to be prepared for that, of course. I know her, he chuckled confidentially. She's no small thing, but wring your heart out. Coming over San Francisco, he was merry. Don't you know the otters will go back in there? I'm certain of it. That fill won't last. There'll be a bay there again. They got him on a stretcher at Hamilton Air Base, and he went unconscious shortly after takeoff. Before he collapsed, he'd insisted on throwing the last of his birdseed on the field. Birds are, of course, warm-blooded, he confided to the agent who was handcuffing him to the stretcher. Then Ayn smiled gently and lapsed into inertness. He stayed that way almost the whole remaining 10 days of his life. By then, of course, no one really cared. Both the government men had died quite early, just after they finished analyzing the birdseed and the throat spray. The woman who had seen him at Kennedy was only just then feeling sickish. The tape recorder they had put by his bed functioned right on through, but if anybody cared to replay it, they would have found little babbling. Gaia Gloriatrix, he crooned. At times, he was grandiose and tormented. Our life, your death, he yelled. Our death would have been your death, too. No need for that. No need. At other times, he was accusing. What did you do about the dinosaurs, he demanded. How did you fix them? Did they annoy you? Cold. Queen, you're too cold. You came close to it this time, my girl. He raved, and then he wept, and caressed the bedclothes, and was maudlin. Only at the end, lying in his filth and thirst, still chained where they had forgotten him, he was suddenly coherent, and a light, clear voice, as one might ask one's lover what to take on a summer picnic, he asked the recorder happily, Have you ever thought about bears? They have so much. Funny they never came along further. By any chance, were you saving them, girl? And he chuckled into his ruined throat until he died. Yeah, that story's from 1969 by a woman using a pseudonym, James Tiptree Jr., a woman who worked in the original cadre of the Central Intelligence Agency after World War II. I kid you not. The book is called The Future is Female, Science Fiction. All female writers. Which brings me to this story by the acclaimed author Ursula K. Le Guin, who says this story is not a werewolf story, but it's called The Wife's Story. He was a good husband, a good father. I don't understand it. I don't believe in it. I don't believe that it happened. I saw it happen, but it isn't true. It can't be. He was always gentle. If you'd have seen him playing with the children, anybody who saw him with the children would have known that there wasn't any bad in him, not one mean bone. When I first met him, he was still living with his mother over near Spring Lake, and I used to see them together, mother and the sons, and think any young fellow that was that nice with his family must be one worth knowing. Then one time when I was walking in the woods, I met him by himself coming back from a hunting trip. He hadn't gotten any game at all, not so much as a field mouse, but he wasn't cast down about it. He was just larking along, enjoying the morning air. That's one of the things I first loved about him. He didn't take things hard. He didn't grouch and whine when things didn't go his way. So we got to talking that day, and I guess things moved right along after that, because pretty soon he was over here pretty near all the time. And my sister said, see, my parents had moved out the year before and gone south, leaving us the place. My sister said, kind of teasing but serious, well, if he's going to be here every day and half the night, I guess there isn't room for me. And she moved out just down the way. We've always been real close, her and me. That's the sort of thing doesn't ever change. I could never have got through this bad time without my sis. Well, so he came to live here. And all I can say is it was the happy year of my life. He was just purely good to me. A hard worker and never lazy, and so big and fine looking. Everybody looked up to him, you know, young as he was. Lodge meeting nights, more and more often they had him to lead the singing. He had such a beautiful voice, and he'd lead off strong, and the others following and joining in, high voices and low. It brings the shivers on me now to think of it, hearing it, nights when I'd stayed home from meeting when the children was babies, the singing coming up through the trees there, and the moonlight, summer nights, the full moon shining. I'll never hear anything so beautiful. I'll never know a joy like that again. It was the moon, that's what they say, is the moon's fault in the blood. It was in his father's blood. I never knew his father, and now I wonder what become of him. He was up from Whitewater way and had no kin around here. I always thought he went back there, but now I don't know. There was some talk about him, tales, that come out after what happened to my husband. It's something runs in the blood, they say, and it may never come out. But if it does, it's the change of the moon that does it. Always it happens in the dark of the moon, when everybody's home asleep. Something comes over the one that's got the curse in his blood, they say, and he gets up because he can't sleep, and goes out into the glaring sun, and goes off all alone, drawn to find those like him. And it may be so, because my husband would do that. I'd half rouse and say, where you going? And he'd say, oh, hunting, be back this evening. And it wasn't like him. Even his voice was different. But I'd be so sleepy and not wanting to wake the kids, and he was so good and responsible, it was no call of mine to go asking why and where and all like that. So it happened that way maybe 3 times or 4. He'd come back late, worn out, pretty near cross for one so sweet-tempered, not wanting to talk about it. I figured everybody got to bust out now and then, and nagging never helped anything. But it did begin to worry me. Not so much that he went, but that he come back so tired and strange. Even he smelled strange, made my hair stand up on end. I could not endure it, and I said, what is that, those smells on you, all over you? And he said, I don't know, real short, made like he was sleeping. But he went down when he thought I wasn't noticing and washed himself. But those smells stayed in his hair and in our bed for days. Then the awful thing. I don't find it easy to tell about this. I want to cry when I have to bring it to my mind. Our youngest, the little one, my baby, she turned from her father just overnight. He come in and she got scared, looking stiff, with her eyes wide. And then she begun to cry and try to hide behind me. She didn't yet talk plain, but she was saying over and over, make it go away, make it go away. The look in his eyes, just for one moment when he heard that. That's what I don't want ever to remember. That's what I can't forget. The look in his eyes, looking at his own child. I said to the child, shame on you. What's got into you? Scolding, but keeping her right up close to me at the same time, because I was frightened too, frightened to shaking. He looked away then and said something like, "Guess she just waked up dreaming," and passed it off that way, or tried to, so did I. And I got real mad with my baby when she kept on acting crazy scared of her own daddy, but she couldn't help it and I couldn't change it. He kept away that whole day because he knew, I guess, it was just beginning, darker than moon. It was hot and close inside and dark, and we'd all been asleep some while when something woke me up. He wasn't there beside me. I heard a little stir in the passage when I listened, so I got up because I could hear it no longer. I went out into the passage, and it was light there, hard sunlight coming in from the door, and I saw him standing just outside in the tall grass by the entrance. His head was hanging. Presently he sat down like he felt weary and looked down at his feet. I held still inside and watched. I didn't know what for. And I saw what he saw. I saw the changing in his feet. It was first. They got long. Each foot got longer, stretching out. The toes stretching out and the foot getting long and fleshy and white and no hair on them. The hair begun to come away all over his body. It was like his hair fried away in the sunlight and was gone. He was white all over then, like a worm skin, and he turned his face. It was changing while I looked. It got flatter and flatter, the mouth flattened wide and the teeth grinning flat and dull, and the nose just a knob of flesh with nostril holes, and the ears gone and the eyes gone blue. Blue with white rims around the blue, staring at me out of that flat, soft, white face. He stood up then on two legs. I saw him. I had to see him. My own dear love turned into the hateful one. I couldn't move, but as I crouched there in the passage staring out into the day, I was trembling and shaking with a growl that burst out into a crazy, awful howling, a grief howl and a terror howl and a calling howl, and the others heard it even sleeping and woke up. It stared and peered, that thing my husband had turned into, and shoved its face up to the entrance of our house. I was still bound by mortal fear, but behind me the children had waked up and the baby was whimpering. The mother anger came out into me then, and I snarled and crept forward. The man thing looked around. It had no gun like the ones from the man places do, but it picked up a heavy fallen tree branch in its long white foot and shoved the end of that down into our house at me. I snapped the end of it in my teeth and started to force my way out because I knew the man would kill our children if he could. But my sister was already coming. I saw her running at the man with her head low and her mane high and her eyes yellow as the winter sun. It turned on her and raised up that branch to hit her. But I come out the doorway mad with the mother anger, and the others all were coming answering my call, the whole pack gathering there in that blind glare and heat of the sun at noon. The man looked round at us and yelled out loud and brandished the branch it held. Then it broke and ran, heading for the cleared fields and plowlands down the mountainside. It ran on two legs, leaping and weaving, and we followed it. I was last because love still bound the anger and the fear in me. I was running when I saw them pull it down. My sister's teeth were in its throat. I got there and it was dead. The others were drawn back from the kill because of the taste of the blood and the smell. The younger ones were cowering and some were crying, and my sister rubbed her mouth against her forelegs over and over to get rid of the taste. I went up close because I thought if the thing was dead, the spell, the curse must be done, and my husband could come back alive or even dead. If I could only see him, my true love in his true form, beautiful. But only the dead man lay there, white and bloody. We drew back and back from it and turned and ran back up into the hills, back to the woods of the shadows and the twilight and the blessed dark. That's Ursula K. Le Guin, The Wife Story from 1979, and a collection called Buffalo Gals and Other Animal Presences. And this last bit, I hope I can finish it in the next few minutes. I think so. It's called by her also, Ursula K. Le Guin. It's called She Unnames Them. Most of them accepted namelessness with the perfect indifference with which they had so long accepted and ignored their names. Whales and dolphins, seals and sea otters consented with particular grace and alacrity, sliding into anonymity as into their element. A faction of yaks, however, protested. They said that yak sounded right and that almost everyone who knew they existed called them that. Unlike the ubiquitous creatures such as rats or fleas who had been called by hundreds of thousands of different names since Babel, the yaks could truly say, they said, that they had a name. They discussed the matter all summer. The councils of the elderly females finally agreed that though the name might be useful to others, it was so redundant from the yak point of view that they never spoke it themselves, and hence might as well dispense with it. After they presented the argument in this light to their bulls, a full consensus was delayed only by the onset of severe early blizzards. Soon after the beginning of the thaw, their agreement was reached and the designation yak was returned to the donor. Among the domestic animals, few horses had cared what anybody called them since the failure of Dean Swift's attempt to name them from their own vocabulary. Cattle, sheep, swine, asses, mules, and goats, along with chickens, geese, and turkeys, all agreed enthusiastically to give their names back to the people to whom, as they put it, they belonged. A couple of problems did come up with pets. The cats, of course, steadfastly denied ever having had any name other than those self-given, unspoken, ineffably personal names which, as the poet named Eliot said, they spend long hours daily contemplating, though none of the contemplators has ever admitted that what they contemplate is in fact their name. And some onlookers had wondered if the object of that meditative gaze might not in fact be the perfect or platonic mouse. In any case, it is a moot point now. It was with the dogs and with some parrots, lovebirds, ravens, and minas that the trouble arose. These verbally talented individuals insisted that their names were important to them and flatly refused to part with them. But as soon as they understood that the issue was precisely one of individual choice and that anybody who wanted to be called Rover or Frou Frou or Polly or even Birdie in the personal sense was perfectly free to do so, not one of them had the least objection to parting with the lowercase or, as regards German creatures, uppercase generic appellations, poodle, parrot, dog, or bird, and all the Linnean qualifiers that had trailed along behind them for 200 years like tin cans tied to a tail. The insects parted with their names in vast clouds and swarms of ephemeral syllables buzzing and stinging and humming and flitting and crawling and tunneling away. As for the fish of the sea, their names dispersed from them in silence throughout the oceans like faint, dark blurs of cuttlefish ink and drifted off on the currents without a trace. None were left now to unname. And yet how close I felt to them when I saw one of them